Well, it's a great pleasure to help celebrate Gary's 60th birthday. I really have fond memories of all our collaborations, those magic moments when we both believed that we had violated cosmic censorship. Unforgettable. And it was also enriching because it was so different from your style, was so different from what I had introduced to being in Cambridge. On several occasions in Cambridge, I was told there was no calculation needed because, as Stephen would say, it's unreasonable to think the result would not be this or that. Whereas with Gary, from day one, I learned it was unreasonable not to do a calculation. It was very good. It was very good. Also, Gary, over the years, Santa Barbara has become like a second home for me and my family. And really, this has everything to do with the hospitality of the Gravity Group at UCSB. And I'd like to thank you for that very much. So I'm going to talk about holographic signatures of cosmological singularities. And I'm going to make, like George, no attempt to hide Gary's contributions. In fact, I'm kind of hoping that you guys might want to know what Gary's up to now. But Gary, there will be one new equation which I have highlighted especially for you. In fact, the roots of what I'm going to talk about go back to some old work of Gary and myself. Back in 2004, we constructed what we called ADS cosmologies, which is essentially we put the big crunch singularity in an ADS box. And the appealing thing about that was, of course, the motivation behind this was to learn to use ADS CFT, to learn something about cosmological singularities. So that seemed appealing, and it was certainly progress. Except for one man in Cambridge who complained that merely 2 years after my PhD, I had given up on the notion of a unique state of the universe. Because here you can start, of course, with any initial data and evolve this forward. Now, the trick, of course, when you want to study cosmological singularities in the context of ADS-CFT, the only trick really is that you have to get the singularity in without destroying the system completely. And back in 2004, Gary and I used a scalar field, one of these tachyonic scalar fields in ADS supergravity for that. In fact, we considered a simple consistent truncation of n equals 8 down to gravity in ADS4 coupled to one of these negative mass scalars with a negative potential. And in all asymptotically ADS solutions, the scalar field falls off as a combination, in this case, of these two modes. Now, if either alpha or beta would be zero, the system is stable. Well, let's say that cosmic censorship would let you to believe there exist no solutions that develop big crunch singularities. But you can impose alternative boundary conditions which preserve the asymptotic ADS symmetries, which do admit solutions where regular initial data that are asymptotically ADS evolve into a big crunch singularity. And we construct explicit examples using one of Gary's favorite tricks, right? Some weak rotation. So we started with the Euclidean Einstein equation, solved it using a lot of symmetry to get Euclidean domain walls, essentially. Starting with some regular conditions in the interior, the scalar field falls off asymptotically. You define your boundary conditions by choosing an appropriate constant F that satisfies that relation, and the restriction of those data to the equator of the tree sphere yields you initial data for a Lorentzian solution. The Lorentzian evolution itself, which is given by the analytic continuation of the Euclidean solution and amounts the origin of the Euclidean solution there in the middle turns into a light cone in ADS which hits the boundary at finite time. And inside that light cone, the entire cosmology is happening. it evolves inside the light cone. The system evolves like an open universe in which the scale factor reaches a maximum and then in finite time goes to zero, producing a Big Crunch singularity extending all the way to infinity in finite global time. So that was appealing. And back in those days, the kind of key question going around in the community was, well, what happens then next? What happens? Is there any notion of semi-classical space-time beyond the Big Crunch? And you could analyze this in the dual framework. So this was the whole goal of our of that setup. Let's go to the dual to see what happens. The dual is now well known, of course. It's AVGM theory, which has 8 scalars. And with the usual boundary conditions, where beta is 0, the bulk scalar that we had turned on in the bulk and which was driving our cosmology and causing the Big Crunch corresponds to a dimension 1 operator, which is a combination of 2 of these scalar fields. But we had explicitly imposed alternative ADS boundary conditions in order to generate that cosmological dynamics. And those boundary conditions correspond to adding an extra term to the potential in the dual theory. In this case, for this particular solution that I was describing here, it corresponds to adding a marginal triple trace deformation with a negative coefficient. Why with a negative coefficient? Well, we could only find cosmological solutions for negative values of F. Then, well, there was no accident in retrospect. And the dual evolution of those cosmologies amounts to the evolution of one of the expectation values of the operators of the dual field running off to infinity, starting across the barrier of the potential. So the triple trace term, because it was negative, leads in field space to certain directions where the potential became unbounded from below. Unbounded so steeply that the field seemingly ran off in finite time. But in fact, while that field rolls down, it later became clear, the potential energy is already converted into particles. So most of the potential energy is drained while the evolution towards the Big Crunch proceeds. And the Big Crunch itself would correspond to the field, in fact, reaching infinity. So there was clearly absolutely no sign of any bounds or any Big Crunch, Big Bang transitions in these toy models of cosmologies embedded in ADS, asymptotic ADS spaces. But later, with hindsight, it was probably somewhat misguided to consider those space-times from the perspective of a global ADS boundary. And indeed, a couple of years ago, Malasina and other people suggested a different interpretation of the same solutions in which the original SO4 symmetry was in fact put to use outside the light cone as well. It was guaranteeing Robertson-Walker symmetry inside the light cone and yielding that cosmology, but outside the light cone, the symmetry implied that the scalar field was in fact constant on these, the sitter slices of asymptotic ADS spaces, so you can slice asymptotic ADS space with the sitter slices, and our solutions had a property that the scalar field was constant on those slices. And furthermore, those slices, here all the way at the top, zoomed right underneath the state just below the Big Crunch singularity. And so that led to a reinterpretation of those solutions as solutions with beta equals constant boundary conditions, but with the field theory viewed on the sitter space, three-dimensional the sitter space. A conformal field theory on three-dimensional the sitter space has the conformal coupling of the scalars, R phi squared term. And so adding a slightly negative So beta equals constant, boundary conditions would correspond to adding a small negative mass term to that field theory. But because of the conformal coupling of the field theory, the R phi square term, everything seems fine. The field theory, in fact, seems well-defined for all time because the De Sitter time just goes on and on and on. So it's an appealing reinterpretation. And one, I think, that could still further be explored. But in fact, one may wonder if one cannot even go further. Because we have this De Sitter evolution, we have a field theory. Nothing much changes. It's in a kind of static configuration on the De Sitter space. But in these specific solutions, the perturbations initially or the field configurations are put in their vacuum state because that's kind of how we construct those solutions. But eventually then, when the De Sitter evolution ensues, the configuration can become pretty complicated, the field configuration. But the key point is that the actual cosmological evolution, it happens entirely in one of those diamond regions in ADS. So one may wonder, do we even need, sorry, yes. Yes, yes, so. Precisely because the CFT is on a De Sitter space, so it's a conformal field theory, so all scalars have the R phi squared coupling, and I can take beta to be as small as I like. So the coefficient of the negative mass term, which I'm adding to the field theory, can be small. For any, even also for very small values of that coefficient, we have those solutions that do produce a big crunch. So I just want to throw it out as a thought here, but do we really need that De Sitter evolution? This entire cosmology is happening in one diamond region of ADS, and like the true dictionary of ADS-CFT, what we're ultimately all after is really a dictionary between states on the boundary and wave functions in the bulk. Here we have a suggestion that the asymptotic state of the boundary field theory should correspond somehow to a Wheeler-DeWitt wave function, which is a function of the scale factor n phi and should therefore capture, in a way, this entire cosmological evolution. And if you're worried about this light cone, small variations of our solutions can be easily constructed, which exhibit both a big bang and a big crunch singularity, all happening inside that one diamond region. So it's intriguing as a dual picture of a Toymal cosmology, but very abstract and not easy to develop into a concrete dictionary. But one thing which it does suggest, just on general grounds of how such a field theory state in a De Sitter space will evolve, is that the quantum nature of such cosmological singularities certainly appears to be encoded in the long distance behavior of the boundary state, because that's where asymptotically the interesting non-trivial physics in the De Sitter space is certainly happening. Now, in order to even begin to do this, we better have a set of analytic explicit solutions. So Gary, I thought as a birthday present, I'll present you with one where we have a free parameter which we can vary and perhaps begin to play around with those ideas. Now, going back another way, more concrete and slightly less ambitious, but also very interesting, is to stick to that De Sitter picture and begin to probe the singularity with all sorts of boundary anchored extremal surfaces, like geodesics and so forth. But also, if you want to do that, you run into trouble, because in the cosmologies that I described, in the solutions that I described, there are no probes that are anchored on the boundary, which enter beyond the surface inside the diamond region where the scale factor reaches its maximum and where the interesting stuff actually begins to happen. It's really the very last part of that cosmological evolution where the dynamics is non-trivial. However, you can get around that, and this is the Sitter dual view suggests a way to get around that. You could get around the problem by adding anisotropy to the De Sitter boundary. In fact, anisotropy is enough to produce big crunch singularities. Once you're dealing with anisotropic solutions, you don't even need a scalar field anymore. So now I come to our more recent work. Forget about the scalar field, but go up one dimension to five dimensions and consider the following solution. Instead of the plain ADS solution, replace the metric of the flat slices by a Kasner metric, a four-dimensional Kasner metric, and we slice ADS that way. And now let's do the same. Let's rewrite this solution a little bit. Let's pull out a factor of t squared, divide by t squared, and some scale h squared. This is just Kasner ADS, rewritten in slightly unusual way, which allows us via in terms of this tau coordinate, to write these slices inside these brackets as anisotropic De Sitter spaces. So now we just to apply the same trick, we view Kasner ADS in anisotropic De Sitter slices, which zoom hover just above the singularity, which happens at t equals zero in the past here. So we have a Kasner singularity, but we're going to study this from a boundary perspective where we put the boundary field theory on those anisotropic slices. Notice also there's an interesting symmetry, a dilation symmetry, which acts on the boundary itself and is therefore an isometry of these boundary slices. So with those solutions, we're in business. We can calculate boundary two-point functions. And we do this by calculating space-like balanced geodesics anchored on endpoints on the boundary in order to compute two-point functions of CFT operators with large dimensions. So that's a kind of saddle point approximation in the Balak that applies for large dimension operators. So here we have a two-point function in some state, and the statement is that this is given by the regularized length of the Balak space-like geodesic connecting these two endpoints on the boundary, where M is then related to the dimension of the operator O, of which we calculate the two-point function. This is not an easy problem because of all the anisotropy, but it's manageable for equal time correlators, and if we separate the two points in each of these directions separately. In each direction, we're going to get a different result because precisely of the anisotropy. The dilation symmetry also allows us to set t equals 1, and so let's separate these two points in the x1 direction and set the other directions, the separation to 0. If you do that for those specific separations, the geodesics essentially move in an effectively three-dimensional space. There's one, the Kasner coefficient in the one direction where we separate the points is what really comes in. So we have the time, the radial direction, and this one non-trivial direction. If you use x as a parameter, then the geodesics satisfy the following equation. And from this you can see, well, at some point, so we separate the two points in the x1 direction, let's say from minus x to plus x, so at x equals 0, the geodesics better turn around, so t prime is 0, which means from here you can see that if p is negative, the geodesics will be bending towards the singularity, whereas for when p is positive, the geodesics always go away. So that reflects the problem we had before. P positive, it's the situation for an isotropic cosmology, where we had that extremist barrier where we couldn't get past with our probes, but P negative directions evade that problem and in fact allow the geodesics to get arbitrarily close to the singularity. Incidentally, there's always, once you're in five dimensions, there's always one, at least one negative p direction. So for those in that setup, thanks to Netta's courage, we managed to solve the equations. The solutions are for the geodesics are difficult, but they simplify for certain values of p. And for the purpose of this talk, I'll focus on one such value, and I'll explain the general result towards the end. So for instance, one such value, which is tractable, is p1 equal to minus a quarter. Then the solutions are given by the following two equations. So now I've parameterized the geodesics as functions of time. W is essentially is root t. And so we have two functions, two solutions, x of time and z of time. Now at the boundary, as I mentioned, t is 1. Obviously, z is 0. And therefore, the boundary separation is 2 times x evaluated at 1. If you evaluate x at 1, you see it's given by the integration constant c in those equations. There's one integration constant left after you've imposed all constraints, and that integration constant c is essentially what determines or what is related to the boundary separation of the points. But you can see immediately from this equation that there's not going to be a one-to-one correspondency. Indeed, if you plot the various solutions, so there's essentially the boundary separation is essentially given by a quintic equation in C, so you have 5 solutions, and here they are, all 5 of them. There's the boundary separation between the points in that one direction we focus on, and here's the real part of the integration constant C. And all the different colors indicate all the 5 different solutions. The full curves on this diagram indicate geodesics for which C is real, and the entire geodesic is real. The dotted lines indicate geodesics which are complex. So for fixed boundary value, pick anyone, we have 5 solutions. And now you have to use physical intuition and a little bit of phenomenology in order to select which saddle point, which geodesics contribute to the two-point function we ultimately are interested in. So it's helpful to have a closer look at what these geodesics are actually doing for these different values of C. And there's a clear distinction, it turns out, between positive values of the real part of C and negative values. So these geodesics, obviously, they turn around in the middle at x equals 0. And from the equations, it follows that that happens at w equals minus c. That means that all geodesics where the real part of C is positive, in fact, on their way, they go through the singularity and they turn around somewhere down for negative values there. That is, in principle, these are valid solutions because the solutions of the geodesics are perfectly analytic and well-defined. But it turns out that if you were to include those geodesics, you really do run into trouble as far as the resulting correlator is concerned. They give you physical contributions to the final correlator we're interested in. So we decided that to discard contributions from those geodesics and to keep all contributions from the remaining set of geodesics. Eliminating further contributions leads again to contradictions with the correlator or serious difficulties in making sense of the result. Really, what this is about, underlying this selection, is a kind of statement about the state of the dual field theory, or the state associated with the singularity, which we are beginning to explore with these techniques. So focusing on those geodesics, we can integrate the length, get the regularized length of the geodesics, and this is the result. So there are three important points to note here. When C goes to minus one, as you could see from here, when C goes to minus one, the boundary length goes to zero. This is really the short distance limit, and that should all be standard stuff, just like in pure areas. And that is indeed what turns out. The boundary separation is small. When C goes to minus one, the regularized length of the bulk geodesics is equal to two times the logarithm of the boundary separation. You substitute this in the formula for the correlator, and you find a behavior on short distance scales, which is just the normal short distance divergence. Now, if C goes to zero, you see that the regularized length diverges again. But the boundary length goes to a finite value. In fact, it goes to the horizon size under the Sitter boundary. In that particular direction, the horizon size associated with the one direction in which we're separating our two points. Because the regularized length diverges, you substitute it in the correlator, that leads to a pull in the correlator, which is extremely interesting. All the more because it turns out that it's associated with geodesics that go close, that go very close to the singularity. When C goes to zero, this geodesic goes closer to the singularity and at the same time remains closer to the boundary. It's as if the singularity pushes out the geodesics and forces it to stay close to the boundary. Nevertheless, this tip goes down and thus, in fact, probe the very high curvature region near the singularity. It's that geodesic which is responsible, or that set of geodesics, which is responsible for the pole at horizon size in the dual theory. The final point to notice is that for large boundary separations, the regularized length goes like the logarithm of the boundary separation to the 8.5, which for this particular value of p, namely p equals minus a quarter, means that the correlator at large scales behaves like minus two over two times delta over the horizon size in that direction. Which is also an interesting feature that is distinct from the result you would get in pure Sitter or in pure ADS, anyway, in the absence of a big crunch singularity. This is just to summarize what I just said, but put in a graph where we have the three contributions to the correlator added. These guys, which produce the short distance behavior, these guys, which lead to the pole at horizon size, and these complex geodesics, which determine the long distance behavior of the correlator, which are there. So those are the three key features in this particular case. Now it turns out that even though the detailed picture of which geodesics there exists and how these different curves are is very different for different values of p, the three features that I've mentioned, that I've described, are the same for all values of p. But even though the details of the analysis seem rather p dependent, at the end of the day, the key features seem generic for generic values of p. That is, we never have a pole in p greater than zero directions. Those are geodesics which bend away from the singularity. We always have a pole in the p less than zero directions. And for large boundary separations, the behavior is always, on long distances, is always governed by the horizon scale in that particular direction. And the short distance behavior is always universal. Fine. Now, of course, the key question is, what does this mean? what is the interpretation of the pole at the horizon size? So I thought I would end with a conjecture, but I'm going to go step by step with the conjecture to make it sound somewhat plausible, I guess. So one thing to note is that the anisotropy in this particular case, it's not a small anisotropy. In fact, it gets larger closer to the singularity. So large that the system effectively reduces to 1+1 dimension. In the Kasner frame, this is obvious. There are two directions which are shrinking and one which is expanding. But also in the De Sitter, from a De Sitter boundary perspective, the ratio of the sizes of the different dimensions goes to zero. There's only one dimension that dominates. Away from the singularity. Effectively, think about the. Oh, QFT, you mean? Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, okay, so think for a moment about the Kasner frame, perhaps that's the cleanest. Two directions are shrinking, one is expanding near a singularity. So essentially the system, you might hope, becomes to some approximation 1+1 dimension. It's this direction, the direction which expands near a singularity in the Kasner frame. This is the negative direction, and this is the only direction in which we find a pole. Of course, perhaps if we separate the points slightly in other directions, we'll still have a pole, but we have good reasons to believe that if we separate them significantly in the other directions, the behavior will be finite and probably and disappear altogether when we are having points in separated only in the positive p directions. Now consider a 1+1 CFT after a quantum quench. As John Cardi explained us, correlators of some operators in such systems show a large bump precisely at the horizon size, where by horizon size there, we mean the light cone essentially emanating from the system at starting at a given time. Eh? So this is determined not necessarily by the velocity of light, but by the velocity of sound in that case. And John gave a nice colloquium in which he interpreted that evolution following a quantum quench in terms of an EPR pair of quasi-particles moving in opposite directions. So we have one dimension. Think of it as the initial state or the state associated with the singularity. And then we have that quasi-particle picture with which essentially are EPR pairs moving in opposite directions. That system produces, in the two-point correlator, a bump precisely at horizon sizes at all times, larger and larger scales when time evolves forward. So the conjecture is that maybe this has something to do with our system. In the sense that we, of course, the objection that you might raise is that, well, we find a pole where, obviously, in these kind of systems, you find a large bump in the two-point function. But we find a pole in a calculation based on bulk space-like geodesics, which is a calculation that surely should break down when the geodesics probe too close or come too close to the singularity. So we're kind of hopeful that finite end corrections, which can be large for these large dimension operators, can turn the actual pole that we find in a pronounced feature, but regularized feature at horizon scales. So that's where we stand. Thank you, and happy birthday again, Gary. It says 30 here.
reason to come around, because it may be a very naive question. But is your boundary metric is Kasner, is that right?
Well, we view the system on the sitter space. So the boundary is the sitter space. Anisotropic the sitter space. Sorry,
anisotropic the sitter.
Yes.
But sorry, maybe I misunderstood, but there's no singularity at T is zero on the boundary.
So the regime close to the Bullock singularity, yeah, I should have said this. When you evolve towards the Bullock singularity, this corresponds to evolving towards infinity in global anisotropic de Sitter space. So that is what I kind of said in the beginning. The cosmology is also in the isotropic models. Infinity in the Sitter space is really where the whole big crunch in the Bullock resides.
But there would be maybe another conformal frame where there's a singularity. So you probably, is that right?
You've to answer your question, if I were to go back in anisotropic de Sitter space to the throat, there would be a singularity in the boundary metric in these particular models.
Yes, there's a conformal frame where the boundary metric is exactly Kasner.
Yeah.
But we choose to work with the conformally related frame.
And I'm just wondering, for example, is the boundary stress tensor regular at this T is zero point?
So,
because I mean, you're looking at geodesics, but a simpler thing to look at might be the boundary stress tensor.
So, the stress tensor is. Well, we have in the simple models that I presented, not at infinity, but down at the throat, on a light-like sheet, right? We have a singularity, a null singularity, but that can be resolved by letting these Kasner coefficients become slightly time-dependent. Because the boundary metric is at our disposal, right? So we can... And that would be a completion of the model. We've verified that throat, I mean, that problem at the throat does not affect any of our results about the geodesics because they stay far away from that region. So this is like the full model that we have in mind, but for simplicity, I didn't,
I'm sorry, Gary, I think I asked you this before and I just forget the answer, but I'd like to understand how much the strong coupling in the field theory is involved in the existence of this pole. So if you just do free fields or let's say weakly interacting fields on this Kasner, what do you get?
Yes, so that's another, it's all a little vague, but in that last conjecture that I sort of proposed, yes, the semi-classical gravity calculation that we do is something at infinite coupling, and you might hope that at finite coupling, these bumps in one of some sort of a follow quantum quench system would be regularized.
Yeah, I just mean a more remedial question, just weak coupling in the field theory on this Kasner, de Sitter-esque thing.
You could do that. So what happens there? I strongly doubt that weak coupling in these anisotropic de Sitter spaces, that you have any kind of pole in the field.
Sounds surprising, but you could also incorporate a weak coupling.
Unfortunately, even that calculation is tricky because the anisotropy is large, and so the dimensions in which you sort of formulate your UV properties of the field, the weak field theory calculations, those dimensions are different from the dimensions which dominate a long distance behavior, and it all mixes up. Yeah.
Regarding your conjecture, so you're still using these geodesics in the bulk to study the sort of correlator, but you know, in many contexts, like a simpler one that we studied with Steve Schenker and friends, long time ago, if you have a geodesic that bounces off the singularity, that need not give the correlator. So what is your evidence for thinking that, you know, your geodesic bounces from the singularity should have anything to do?
So our situation, we obviously, that hadn't escaped our notice, that you guys had excluded singularities bouncing, geodesic bouncing off the singularities. But the geodesics are very different. You guys had a kind of null geodesics bouncing off the singularities.
They were space-like. They were just...
Yeah, it was approaching, But we have a geodesic which remains close to the boundary, And we see, we've tried, and we see no motivation to exclude, in our case, these geodesics. If we were to do it, we would run into trouble at even larger scales, in fact, where we have one real geodesic splitting into two complex geodesics, and that would not match very well. So we think the situation is different. Also, the behavior of the geodesics is rather different from what you guys had.